Verde Gallery, featuring Dia de los Muertos, a celebration of art, music, words, and dance, starts October 25th and runs through December 4th. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
Miles Davis, Freddie Freeloader from Kind of Blue. Think of Miles Davis, and chances are the word hip leaps to mind. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we take a look at hip. What is it? Why does it exist? Journalist and critic John Leland is our guest. He is the author of Hip, The History. Leland says hip is the unacknowledged flip side of America's racial history. In the introduction to this history, he says, hip tells a story of black and white America and the dance of conflict and curiosity that binds it. In a history often defined by racial clash, hip offers an alternative account of centuries of contact and emulation of back and forth. This line of mutual influence, which we seldom talk about, is one of the central life-giving arteries. Though the line often disappears in daily life, through segregation, job discrimination, and the racial split in any school cafeteria, it surfaces in popular culture where Americans collect their fantasies of what they may be. The center of American culture runs through Mark Twain and Louis Armstrong, and it is impossible to imagine either's work without both African and European roots. Born in radically different circumstances and separated by history, they have as much in common with each other as with their peers from what either might call the ancestral homeland. Both are classicists and bluesmen, masters of language, breakers of the rules that would hold them apart. What they have in common is hip. That is from the introduction to John Leland's book, Hip, The History. Listeners, I invite your questions and observations about hip for our guest, John Leland. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, John Leland, is a reporter for the New York Times. He is former editor-in-chief of Details. He was one of the first columnists for Spin. His book, Hip, The History, is published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. John, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks, Celeste. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure, sure. You know, it seems a lot easier to cite a person who is hip than it is to define and describe hip. And you begin with a look at the word's etymology, and I think that's a really useful beginning point. Would you talk with us about the origins of the word?
Oh, absolutely. And that was really handy for me as I went through the book to go back to it. The nearest we can tell, hip comes to us from West Africa, from these words in the Wolof language, hippie or heppy, meaning to see or to open your eyes. So it begins not as like a measure of trendiness, but a kind of enlightenment or awareness, and a very special one at that, because who were the people who would be sharing this awareness? Within our country, they were slaves who might use this word to communicate among themselves in the presence of their antagonists. And their awareness or enlightenment would be extremely important to them because of their situation, because they didn't have land or much in the way of money, although some slaves had some money. And what happens to this word, hippie or heppy, as it becomes our hip? Well, the white people, the adventurous ones, have an interest in finding out what it is these slaves are talking about. And they'll venture in and they'll grab it for themselves and they'll use it for their own purposes and claim it for their own. And the African Americans will note this and parody it or satirize it because that's what they can do. And there'll be this kind of back and forth borrowing that produces so much of American culture.
Yeah. When you set out to explore HIP, did you realize that it's such an old story?
Well, that's what made it worth doing. I think if it were just about the cool guys from the 1950s, then I don't think it would have been that interesting for me to tell, in part because the cool guys from the 1950s did a great job of telling their story, and other people have told it as well. But once I realized it was a long story, and I could tell this very long story and draw connections and show us how Walt Whitman is connected with Muddy Waters, is connected with Beck, is connected with the writer Dennis Johnson, say, well, that gets to be a really interesting story.
Yeah. You describe in your book six convergences of HIP, and I suspect we'll talk about some of these as we go on, but maybe you'd give us some sense of what a convergence of HIP means. I think you've just hinted at it there. The artist Muddy Waters, and who did you pair Muddy with there?
I think with Walt Whitman.
With Walt Whitman.
It works more like a spider web than a line. But yeah, there's six periods of time that I identified where HIP sort of flourished as this alternative intellectual movement, which is what I think it is, when there were peoples coming together and curiosity and an economy to support them. So the first I talk about is the 1850s, a period of time that's often known as the American Renaissance, when Walt Whitman, Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Herman Melville wrote their great works. And what did they celebrate? They celebrated the individual over the society, low culture over high culture, the vitality of the vulgar part of American culture, a bit of a principled rebellion, self-reliance, and civil disobedience, and sensuality and eroticism. And those are really all the elements of HIP. And if you think of the hipsters you know in Wicker Park of Chicago or Williamsburg in New York, they're all living by these principles that were written down in the 1850s, 150 years ago.
Yeah. And the channels of HIP, very interesting to think about. That's how HIP is expressed. And that's so crucial to who we are as human beings.
Yes.
Language, religion, music.
Especially language. I mean, you think of a word like bad and how certain people will use the word bad to mean good. And mm-hmm. that seems like it's new. It's just minted or 10 years old or 20 years old. But that goes back to the antebellum years as well. And it goes back to this being able to communicate to the in-crowd without the out-crowd being able to fully follow it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, speaking of language, let's talk about another word, also African in origin, cool.
Cool, that was a fascinating thing. Robert Ferris Thompson at Yale has traced the origins of cool, and he traced it across the semantic continent of Africa. And it turns out that there were versions of cool in most African languages with a lot of particularly African meanings, like salinity, saltiness would be one, or wetness would be one. But it almost always referred to composure in an individual or stability in a social group. And he traced it back to this 15th century king named Ewuare, meaning it is cool. And he was given that name by his people because he had restored peace to a period of warfare. So cool meant this kind of an element of peacefulness to it.
A calming.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you know, we use cool and hip interchangeably, and we probably should, and to just say, well, the language has moved along, and there's no real distinction between them. But at some level, etymologically, there is. And so cool is that kind of composure in an individual in the state, in the face of maybe chaos and roil around him. So that's cool is that kind of mask of mind. And if that's the case, then hip is the intelligence or the thinking behind the mask, the awareness behind the mask.
Yeah, yeah. You write in the book, in its thoughtful repose, cool begins the journey to hip. You have to be in that spot, I suppose, in repose, in order to to become aware.
As I did the research for this book, there's a number of proposed origins of the word hip, and one that I liked comes from this Dictionary of American Tramp and Hobo Slang from the 1930s, when they thought that hip meant came from having your hip boots on, which is incredibly unlikely because that's not a hip image, but but it's beautiful because it's this idea of being protected while the stream is raging around you.
Mm.
You are motionless and dry and still.
Also, another thing that you mentioned in the book is some have suggested that hip comes from the position of sitting on one's hips to smoke opium.
Yes. And I think it's only appropriate that something as elusive as hip has this many roots.
Yeah.
But opium smokers were said to lay the hip. That's what they did. And they could tell each other by these telltale bruises. And so that would be a fellow hip person, and you would want to be able to identify them because they might tell you where you could get opium or be interested in buying it from you.
Yeah. And here we have an interesting intersection of etymology here in terms of, you know, the world of hip is often one of drugs. You know, it involves we'll take a look around at some of the people who epitomize hip, drug users often.
Oh, I think it's the most troubling aspect of hip, that and the poor paternal parenting that's associated with the hipsters. But yes, it's very troubling. I think Terry Southern, who is one of the people I quote in the book, said, well, hip is this kind of hyper-awareness, and it's so painful that it needs to be numbed. And so the hippest anyone had gotten so far was to be permanently on the nod. Now, I don't quite agree with Southern, and I think Southern was a complicated character and was often extremely negative, and he would swing back the other way. But there's something to that. There's this, if this is an alternative intellectual movement, it's a search for ideas and thoughts, and the people who are going to make that search are going to look in the places they're not supposed to look, and one of those places is going to be drugs.
Mm. You know, I quoted from your book in my introduction, and the passage mentions Louis Armstrong and Mark Twain. What they have in common is hip. And then you continue by talking about hip for better and for worse. And, you know, here we have, I think, one of the things we've been just talking about just now, drugs.
Yep.
One of the things for worse. What is hip at its best?
At its best, it's an openness to ideas that aren't your own. And I think if you take it back to that plantation thing, these slaves who are talking about this enlightenment, it's enlightenment they're not supposed to have, and it's a wisdom about the people around them, the white people around them. What it meant for the white people who dove in and grabbed this meaning, this word that they weren't supposed to have, it's kind of the same thing. It's an awareness of themselves and also this other culture that they're not supposed to explore.
Hmm.
And once you do that, there's this chance for conflicting value systems to breed new ideas and new works and new syntheses.
You mentioned a few times in the book one of the driving forces in the story of hip is a pattern of love and theft, a jumble of black and white. Would you talk about hip as love and theft?
Oh, yes. I mean, when I talk about, the white people who borrowed this word, there's a certain admiration, otherwise you wouldn't borrow the word, right? But there's also a sense that one doesn't have to compensate the people you're borrowing it from. The first popular culture in America, and I write a lot about this in the book, is the blackface minstrel show, which is white performers mostly, although there were a few black performers as well, putting on blackface and doing a show that was in part to ridicule the African Americans around them, and it had certainly an offensive edge to it. But also, I think it was to explore what it was to be in the other person's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's that love there, and there's theft. Who benefits from this? It's the white performers and theater owners.
Yeah. I'm going to reintroduce you, John, and maybe you, it sounds like you're a little bit under the weather. So why don't you get a sip of water or something, and I'll reintroduce you and invite listeners to join us this afternoon, join the conversation. John Leland is our guest this afternoon. He's a journalist and critic. We're talking about Hip the History. That is the title of his book. John is a reporter for the New York Times and former editor-in-chief of Details. He was one of the first columnists for Spin. His book, Hip the History, is published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the numbers. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free. Give us a call on the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, thinking about the minstrels, in our day, in recent decades, we've had this discussion, we've had this argument about love and theft. We think of Elvis Presley, you know, the Rolling Stones, Eminem, at once embracing the culture. But, you know, then there's the question mark. Is it an embrace or is it theft?
Well, it's ambiguous. It's really both of those things, isn't it? And if we think of these guys only as thieves, we miss all that they contribute to it, often only by mixing it up. If you think of it like a character like Eminem, you know, he's a fascinating figure on his own. And if we think of him just as a guy who stole an African-American art form, we miss all that's interesting about him. And what he tells us in his records are not just about what it's like to be black, because he never does that. He tells us about who his mother is and who his girlfriend or wife is and the name of his child and the name of the guy who beat him up when he was in fifth grade and what it's like and what his animosities are and who his enemies are. So he really tells us this individual story that happens to be delivered through this form that was created by people who don't look like him.
Hip is of course marketed to us big time. And this is another interesting part of the story here. And as long as we're talking about, you know, an embrace or theft, this would be appropriate here, I think, to bring this up part of the story up. And one of the terms that you use somewhere in the book is, you know, corporate America, I love this, hoovering up anything that is remotely hip. And, you know, to buy hip seems to me unhip, but maybe not, you know? As you point out, hip requires a transaction.
Oh, I mean a different kind of transaction.
Yeah, I know, but you know, if you play with that a little bit.
There's a great quote from Marshall McLuhan in the book. He says, when something is current, it creates currency, meaning money. And it's been, doing the research was really fascinating to me because now it seems that everyone says, oh, hip has become so commercialized. It's just because we see these hip ads on TV all the time and there's hip clothes in the mall. But as I started to do the research, I found that in every period of time I looked at, people made the same complaint. That everything had become too commercial and that what we were living through now was a sellout of something that had been authentic in the past. Even going back into the 1920s, there's one of the Greenwich Village bohemians, Floyd Dell, who appears in the movie Reds, if you've seen that. He said that he felt that bohemia was just this kind of commercial impulse. And he said that, well, America had come to the end of its Puritan phase and was looking to spend its war profits. And it turned to bohemia to teach it how to spend them. And if you think about it, what does hip want? You know, hip wants a constant churn of new styles and new language and leaving behind the old and embracing the new and sometimes taking a leap into the unknown. And what does the market want? The market wants exactly those same things. It wants new styles and leaving behind the old and embracing the new. So the deeper I got into this, the more I thought of hip as something that kind of anticipated the world that we live in now, where what our companies are really selling are sort of images and auras, which is what hip really is.
Mm. So we're all in the hunt for cool together.
We are, and we should all take a break from it once in a while. It can get pretty oppressive, don't you think?
Yeah, it does. I think, where did I read in one of the things that came with the book, you described yourself not as hip, and but as an observer of hip and an occasional conscientious objector.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I had to. It was a good thing to me to begin the book by saying, as you would any history, to say, well, this is a attempt to explore what I don't know. Therefore, I'll do this from the perspective of saying, I don't know what hip is. And what I'll do is do the really, really uncool thing. And I'll ask the questions, which we never ask because it would be too uncool to ask them.
Mm.
But we do have this thing, hip, and it's in our lives, and it affects us in many ways, and affects how we dress and how we talk and where we live and how much it costs. But we don't question it because that would be uncool.
Mm.
So I ask those questions. What is it? Where does it come from? And really, how do we feel about it?
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting for us on line 4, our toll-free line in Indiana. Good afternoon.
Hello. Sort of shaking the memory. There's three things. One, when I was younger, well, at least when I was in college, the general scuttlebutt was that hip came from hipster, which was taken from a term talking about people who laid on their side with their hips on the floor or a table smoking opium. And it always made a lot of sense to me, and I was wondering if you come across that in your examination of this. And secondly, do you mention anything about the little monograph, The White Hipster? And the third thing is, you've already used the word cool a number of times. I was there when that started, in a sense, and it's always confused me why it's gone through so many generations when usually each generation wants to find something that the other one finds, you know, later on doesn't want to use, like duh or something like that. I don't know where that'll end up, but it's, you know, it's a present thing now, but cool's just kept in there for a long time now.
Yeah, cool never went the way of groovy, did it?
No, it didn't. I want to thank the listener for his call. You want to follow through and talk with us a little bit more about why you think cool has hung in there?
I think it's just an enduring concept. It works beautifully as a literal description. Cool is cool. You know, if you don't know the slang meaning of the word cool, I think you can still follow it. We have a need for that word. Groovy or rad or gnarly, you know, I don't think serve that same function.
Mm-hmm. And we talked, this listener must have joined us a little bit after we started, because we did mention the connection between hip and hipster and opium.
Yeah, I will bring up another one that people have brought up in the course of this. There was a period of time when you would say, are you hip, meaning, do you have a pint? Are you carrying a pint? Do you have a hip flask?
Mm-hmm.
And I like that, too.
Yeah.
I think the monograph that he's referring to is an essay that Norman Mailer wrote, The White Negro, Superficial Reflections on the Hipster, which is a fascinating work, and it's a really dense work. And I've come to believe that people think they know it more than they do, and people talk about it more than they've read it, because it's a really complicated essay referring to the hipster at the during the Cold War period, when people had seen that rational societies had used their rationality to build nuclear bombs and the death camps of Dachau. And so if that was the case, what could a civilized person do but retreat into, Mailer thought, you could retreat into irrationality and pathology. And he unfortunately identified these with African American culture, which I think is not quite right. And if he had left that term out of that essay, I think it would hold up really beautifully now.
Hmm. John Leland, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, he's the author of Hip: The History. We invite you, our listeners, to join us this afternoon with questions, observations. Our phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. What kind of insights can literature give us, our literature give us, into HIP?
Oh, you know, so much of this is maintained by language, and our writers are, of course, the masters of language. You know, I think that we can see so much of the continuity of HIP in something like Huckleberry Finn, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, where Twain is using the language to mean two, three, four things at once. And every time we think we understand Huck and Jim and their relationship, the river takes another bend and it goes in another way. And language or literature rather, has sustained some of the stories of HIP. There's sort of some central stories. One would be the romance of the road, which we can see certainly in Jack Kerouac's On the Road, or Muddy Waters' Daddy Rolling Stone. And we can see that romance of the road, that idea that we can leave where we are, transform ourselves, reinvent ourselves as something new, and arrive at a new place, smarter, wiser, more enlightened or more aware than before. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a central story of HIP, and it's what we all do. We grow up in this small town or the big city, and we feel a little awkward, and adolescence is a gawky period of time, and we feel that we can reinvent ourselves, maybe by getting that great job, but maybe just by becoming HIP, having a greater sense of ourselves and greater sense of awareness. Mm-hmm. And American literature particularly is rife with that.
Also, we get back to the idea of, you know, I like the idea of cool and hip in that the act of reading, one must repose, if you will, and open up to what the writer is saying on the page.
Yeah, it forces us to confront an intellect that's not our own. Yeah. And it's important to remember that all of these eras are really intellectually curious. They are not the Fonzie school of HIP or the keeping it real school of HIP, which I think are just cop-outs.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if in your research you'd come across any instances of, I guess specifically in the U.S., my experience with it, but how HIP can manifest itself, let's say a HIP phenomena of clothing or style or speech, can manifest itself on either the West Coast or the East Coast, and then how it seems to have a delayed effect coming into middle of America. And I'd sort of speak of an example. I grew up mostly in Southern California, and then when I was in junior high, we transplanted to a small town in East Tennessee. And I remember the clothes that I was wearing in Southern California and the lingo and, you know, skateboarding, the second wave of skateboarding in the mid-80s was big there. And then when I moved to Tennessee, you know, people kind of looked at me, you know, your hair's the wrong way, you're talking funny clothes. But then within 12 months, 18 months, those fashions of hipness and cool seemed to trickle into sort of, you know, middle America where we were. I was wondering if you'd seen any examples of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think hip happens in places for a reason. It happens where there tends to be a melding together or a meeting together of different ideas and different styles. And so places that have intense immigration, like so much of this comes out of New York because you had, say, African-American in the early part of the century. So you'd have African-Americans coming up from the South, and you would have Eastern European Jews coming in from Europe, and they're meeting in the same cities. And they're meeting in words like ghetto, say, a word that was extremely important to both those populations. And there's what's there. There's jazz clubs, and there's bagels, and there's all these different things, and there's lingo. And so it'll form there and gradually work its way out into the rest of the country. I think that what's happened is that time lag has shortened dramatically, and it's almost nothing now. So it's something that is hip in New York or in California today. We'll be in the middle of the country by later in the afternoon.
Does the caller want to follow up?
No, that's it. Thank you very
much. Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. John Leland, author of Hip the History, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Well, one of the reasons, of course, that something can be really hot on the East or West Coast in the morning and then by afternoon here in the Midwest is because of technology.
Oh, yes.
And just amazing. And here we have, this is, you know, it maybe the latest convergence, the 80s. You know, we have the computer and the internet emerging.
I think that the internet changed everything because it meant that everybody had access wherever you were to almost everything at the same time, and it also meant that nothing was more privileged than anything else. You know, within the internet, there's no mainstream and alternative. There's just all these different sites. And so it means that a site dedicated to quilting will organize its, and the people that visit that site will organize themselves exactly the same way as a site dedicated to weird sexual fantasies or avant-garde jazz. Mm. And so it changed that kind of binary nature of hip, where you were either in or out, you were on the bus or off the bus, and it's made it made hip this much more diffuse thing.
Yeah,
because stuff moves around the world at the speed of a mouse click.
Mm-hmm. And even before, long before the internet, you have industrialization and. Just think of the music world, the music industry. We have studios, and we have the mass manufacture of musical instruments. What else?
Well, everywhere the people that used the technology mm-hmm. well first were, by definition, hip. You know, the early adopters. They're the ones who have the knowledge, understand how to transmit their thoughts through these new technologies. And that would be true of the automobile or the recording industry. And the recording industry, for one thing, had a huge impact on how the music developed in this country. As you mentioned, the manufacture of the guitar meant that everyone could get a guitar cheaply. They could travel around. You didn't need a piano. It was mobile. So we had the emergence of these mobile performers, blues singers, who could travel from town to town and play every kind of music on that piano. Once the record industry emerged, the record industry had its own needs. Say that the vagabond performers would have wanted to play every kind of music so they could entertain every kind of crowd. The record industry would want you to be identifiable as a blues singer. So where in the period of time before the record industry, players would play popular songs and vaudeville tunes and Tin Pan Alley songs and a blues song here and a country song there and an old folk ballad there. Once they got to the recording industry, the recording industry only wanted them to sing the blues. And so it created the performers that emerged through it.
Yeah. Well, what role then does the movement of hip from outside to inside play in the development or perpetuation of stereotypes?
Well, it can perpetuate them and also undermine them. I think that you would hope that there's always this kind of curiosity. But if you would look at say, a contemporary rapper, there's a limit to what kind of image he or she can portray and still be successful. We don't have, you know, a lot of these, a rapper will never rap about, gosh, how hard it is and how much work it is to sit over the pad writing these complicated rhymes and doing all the interviews they have to do. They'll never make a recording about that because that wouldn't be cool.
Mm.
But yet, that's the life of most of the rappers. They spend much more time slaving away over a pad and pencil or working on their contracts or doing interviews or promotional things than they do shooting their rivals or having sex with 12 women. But those are the things that they talk about on their records.
Yeah. Well, doesn't that explain in part why the president, kind of after that first debate, was sent up over and over and over again by everybody from Jon Stewart to Jay Leno over, you know, how he said it was hard work. You know, the business of being president and guiding foreign policy and where we're headed, it's hard work. He said that a number of times, and then he was sent up over and over again,
you know,
for that.
Finally, someone talks about how hard they work, and it becomes a punchline.
Yeah. Among the archetypes of hip is the trickster, and you devote a chapter to the trickster in the book. And before we run out of time, I'd like you to talk about the trickster in hip, how the trickster has emerged over time in hip.
Well, almost every culture has an archetype that we call the trickster, and it's someone that a society creates to break its own rules. Because if all we do is obey our rules, we'll never grow, we'll never learn anything. So the Greeks, say, had Hermes, who stole fire from Apollo. And the African Americans would have a character like Br'er Rabbit, or the Native Americans have Coyote or Raven. And these are characters who create chaos and find the intelligence in the chaos. And they're exceptionally important to us. We think of a character like Bob Dylan would be a great trickster. And when Bob Dylan says, "Don't ask me nothing about nothing, I just might tell you the truth," you know, that's a great trickster line, because he's going to go into the chaos and confuse you, but also speak truth to you.
Mm.
And there'll be truths that the culture might not want or might not know it wants.
Mm. Bugs Bunny, another trickster.
Bugs Bunny is a great trickster, just a troublemaker. I think that the most fun chapter in the book is a chapter I do on cartoons. It focuses greatly on the Warner Brothers cartoons, which I just love, because they're so urban, they're so ethnic, they're everything that they misbehave, they change genders, they drink, they shoot guns. They do all the things that we tell our kids not to do, and we created them and gave them to our children.
Yeah. The little biographical sketch of you in on the cover of the book says you have a son. I don't know how old your son is, but what's hip in his book these days?
Well, not his dad, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
But his world is video games, which I wanted to write about, and I never quite understood well enough.
Mm.
I felt that video game culture was very interesting, but I couldn't understand it well enough. And file sharing, you know, that swapping of information that you're not supposed to swap.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knows a tremendous amount about music that I would have never known when I was his age. He's 16. And has a sense of the connections between Muddy Waters and Rakim, because maybe he downloaded those two songs on the same day.
Hmm. I would imagine, though, you know, I would imagine that you're a much hipper dad than my dad was.
I don't know. I think that hip is this judgment that should be given to us from other people and not something that we should work toward.
Hmm.
Because, you know, we've all been next to somebody or at a party with someone who thought they were really hip and wanted to show us how hip they were. And it makes for a long evening.
It goes back to that pop tune from quite a while ago now, "I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt."
Yeah.
You know, that kind of attitude. Before we have to wrap up, let's go back to talk about another of the channels of HIP. I thought this was really interesting reading about this in your book, religion, and early in HIP's setting down roots in America, the black church, where the outsider becomes sacrosanct.
Right. Well, where we had, you know, before we had television, radio, and malls and mass communication, the orators and the itinerant preachers were the great communicators of the society. America was a culture of orators. And within the African-American church, so many of the stories of HIP were located. We talked before about the romance of the road, but when African-Americans began preaching, one of the most central stories in the black church was the story of Exodus, because it was a deliverance of the people from Egypt to the promised land. And for people who were living in slavery, that was an important story. So there's a way in which the cultures merge in this Christian religion, but the difference is not lost. The difference between the two cultures is maintained. And I think that that's a root to HIP. The African Americans were, preachers were dynamic. They were loud. They could rock the house. They could break some of the rules of the church. People might shout, and they might channel these very African practices. Something known as the ring shout was very important in the slave church. Now, that was just an African tradition that was brought over to America, and had the white slave owners understood it, then they would have forbid it, as they did many other things. But they didn't really. And so certain rituals to river spirits resurfaced in the baptism. So the practice of religion within Christianity within the black church was a conduit for retaining these African elements.
And now if we look at this take another look at this, has there been an impact of the black church in the evolution of mainstream American Christianity?
Well, I think that the popularity of certain black churches and black ministers contributed to the more demonstrative preaching we find in the South. Say, Southern preachers will often burn it up in ways that Northern preachers won't. You know, I'm here in the Northeast, where the preaching tends to be very constrained. When I go to visit my brother in Alabama, it's going to be a lot more dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And if I go to the black churches in Tuscaloosa or Birmingham, it's going to be more dynamic yet.
We have to wrap up here. Last question. You say we're living in a post-HIP era. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that this election to the contrary, almost everyone is HIP now. Almost everyone sees themselves as some sort of rebel or outsider or person who wants to be their own dog or just do it, and HIP is marketed at us so aggressively with the idea that the HIP are not just this small little subset of society, but it's how the vast majority of us see ourselves. And so for there to be a real thing that's HIP, because certainly not everyone can be HIP, otherwise a HIP would have no meaning. The real HIP has to be someplace slightly different. It can't really be in these products that are sold to us as being HIP. It really has to be in the intelligence behind them or the intelligence outside of them. And that, I think, is a kind of post-HIP thing. And if you say you are HIP now, that would be kind of being one of the crowd as opposed to being an outsider. So I think the true hipsters will use HIP almost in quotation marks in a kind of campy or arch way, the trend for the trucker hats. And it means, you know, well, we're too hip for this business of ring-a-ding-ding-ding hip stuff. but isn't that kind of hip?
Hmm. There, we'll leave it. I want to thank you, John, for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, and I apologize that I am a little under the weather.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, no, and I hope you feel better.
It's just that first cold of the season.
Yeah, take care. John Leland has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a reporter for the New York Times, former editor-in-chief of Details, one of the first columnists for Spin. He is the author of Hip, The History. It's published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Jay Pierce.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Indeed, the settlements are in. And as we look, As we take a look at how things wound up on the Board of Trade, we see December wheat had a high price of $3.15 today, a low of $3.08.5. The settlement was $3.09.75, down at 6.5. March wheat, $3.25 was the high. The low was $3.19.25. The settlement, $3.19.75, down 7. May, the high $3.32, the low $3.26. The settlement, $3.26.5, down 7.25. The July contract for wheat, $3.38.5, was the high. The low $3.33. The settlement, $3.33.25, down 6.5. And September 05 wheat, at a high of $3.43.5, a low of $3.40. The settlement was $3.40, and that was down 7 on the day. Into the corn pit, December corn had a high of $2.03.75, a low of $1.99. The settlement was $1.99.25, down 4.75. March, the high today, $2.14.25, the low $2.10. The settlement, $2.10.25, down 4.75 as well. May, the high $2.22.25, the low $2.16.75, the settlement $2.10.25, down 4.75. July corn had a high of $2.29, a low of $2.25, the settlement $2.25.25, down 4. September 05, $2.35 was the high, $2.32.25 the low. That was also the settlement, $2.32.25, down 3.75. And December 05 corn had a high of $2.43.5, a low of $2.40. The settlement, $2.40.25, down 4. December oats had a high of $1.49.5, a low of $1.46.5. The settlement, $1.46.75, down 3/4. In March, $1.54 was the high, $1.51.25 the low, $1.52 the settlement, down 1.5. In soybeans, January contract, $5.57 was the high today, $5.45 was the low. The settlement, $5.50.5, down 4.5. March had a high of $5.61, a low of $5.49. The settlement, $5.54, down 5.75. May soybeans had a high of $5.67.5, a low of $5.56. The settlement, $5.60.5, down 6.25. July, the high, $5.75, the low, $5.62.75, the settlement $5.66.75, down 6. August soybeans had a high of $5.72, a low of $5.67, the settlement $5.70, down 6. And September 05 soybeans had a high of $5.73, a low of $5.70, the settlement $5.72, down 5. December soybean meal had a high of $160.50, a low of $156.70, and the settlement was $158.20, down 190. In January, soybean meal had a high of $162.20, a low of $158.50. The settlement, $160.20, down $140. December soybean oil, the high $21.64, the low $21.16. The settlement, $21.49. That was up 5 on the close. And January soybean oil closed up 11. The high today, $21.78, the low $21.32. The settlement, $21.67. Again, that was up 11. And now with a look at how things settled on the Mercantile Exchange, back to you, Celeste.
Thank you, Jay. Jay, livestock prices were mostly higher today. Two exceptions, February pork bellies and January feeder cattle. January feeder cattle, the high today, $101.30, the low $99.85, finishing at $100.62.5, down 7.5. March, $96.45, the high, $95.05, the low, $96.12.5, the settlement, that up 42.5. April, $95.65, the high, $94.10, the low, $94.92.5, the settlement, that up 57.5. December live cattle, 85.35 the high, 84.20 the low, 84.80 the settlement, that up 17.5. February, 86.60 the high, 85.45 the low, the settlement, 86.07.5, that up 10 cents. December lean hogs, 75.22.5 the high, 74.10 the low, 74.82.5 the settlement, that up 42.5. February, 74.15 the high, 73.10 the low, 73.40 the settlement, that up 22.5. April, 71.30 the high, 69.80 the low, 71.17.5 the settlement, that up 107.5. May, 70.80 the high, 69.35 the low, 70.65 the settlement, that up 135. February pork bellies, 99.45 the high, 98.25 the low, finishing at 99 even, down 72.5. The Dow is off 103 points at 10,470. The NASDAQ off 28 points at 2,076. The S&P 500 down 11 points at 1172.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Deb Hart from Asheville, North Carolina writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why don't physicists ever smile?"
Well, the fact is, physicists are almost always smiling. An excess of cranial gray matter causes this smile to become habitually inverted. Approximating the two-dimensional graph of the equation y equals cosine x minus sine y. When a physicist appears to be smiling, then we're all in trouble. A laughing physicist is a strong indicator that it's time to head for the fallout shelter. If a physicist ever attempts to tell you a joke, leave the room as quickly as possible. Don't even bother to manufacture an excuse. Just run.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Or programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
It's a minute and a half before 2 o'clock Central Time, 54 degrees in Urbana. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn, Jason Croft, our technical director today, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Let's take a look now at Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana. This afternoon, in the north and in eastern Indiana, cloudy with